Have you ever been asked to do something crazy? I mean, one of those things where somebody comes to you and says, hey, let's go do this, you know, and you're like, you want me to do what? I mean, just something flat out crazy. I won't spend a lot of time here. I've been asked to do a few crazy things as a pastor, conduct a funeral for a cat, among some other things. I've been requested some pretty things that you would be a little in awe about. But I think from time to time, no matter what we do, who we are, we've been requested and asked to do some crazy things. And that's how the story begins with the prophet Hosea. In fact, God has been known to ask several of these Old Testament prophets to do some pretty crazy things in our minds. Now, one time, Isaiah chapter 20, I don't have time to take you there, perhaps you write it down because you're not going to believe me, you just have to read it for yourself. Isaiah chapter 20, God asked Isaiah to walk around the city in the middle of the streets, nearly naked, for a long period of time for the purpose of foreshadowing the types of judgment that God was going to bring on Egypt. I don't know about you, among the many things that I've been asked to do as a preacher, I'm glad I've never been asked to do that, all right? That's a pretty crazy thing. And so we read some of these things sometimes, we're thinking, what in the world? Why did God ask him to do it? And the whole scene, this crazy act, this action sermon, as some would like to call it, was just God's way of trying to get Egypt's attention of the judgment that was going to come unto them. And I don't know of any reason why we would rebuke the idea that getting attention is watching a preacher run through the streets half naked crying about judgment. That would definitely get our attention. And so that's why God would use it. You think that's bad? I could take you to the book of Ezekiel. In fact, again, I don't have time to read it to you. Perhaps you'd write it down because, again, you probably won't believe me unless you read it for yourself. But Ezekiel chapter 4, God once asked the prophet Ezekiel to do several things in that entire chapter. In fact, there's five or six things that he asked Ezekiel to do that were just kind of crazy. And they were all for the purpose of, again, foreshadowing the type of judgment that would come to Israel. None the least of which was God asking Ezekiel there in chapter 4 to lay on his left side for 390 days facing Jerusalem to depict the number of years that Israel had been in rebellion against God. And then after he laid down on those 390 days, he had to turn to his right side and lay down that 40 days to depict the judgment of Israel. The first was judgment of Judah, the second was judgment of Israel and the sin and rebellion that they had lived in. Just kind of crazy. Why would he ask him to do that? Then in that whole scene, God comes to Ezekiel and he says, now, in the midst of all of this, while you're laying on your left side and then you go to lay on your right side, here's something else I want you to do. I want you to get all this weird group of foods. It was not a normal layout, a normal spread, just this conglomeration of weird foods that don't go together. You can read about it in Ezekiel chapter 4. And he said, I want you to put them together. And listen, I want you to take these foods and I want you to cook it over an open flame made out of dried human dung, all right? Now, I am appreciative of what Ezekiel did when God asked him to do that. He's like, okay, the 390 days on the left side and the 40 days on the right side, I get it, no problem there. But please, God, do not let me have to eat food that's cooked over dried human dung. And here's how gracious God was. He said, okay, I won't make you do that. So he says, take out the human dung and replace it with cow dung, all right? That's what you're going to have to do. And so Ezekiel said, well, at least it isn't human dung. I'll do it over cow dung. And he had cooked the fire. You say, why did God ask him to do it? Well, he tells us at the end of that chapter, it was all about how sin had polluted Israel and how this food intake was a pollution to Ezekiel's body, and it represented the judgment that was going to come upon the people. And all of these peculiar, rare things that God would often come to Old Testament prophets and ask them to do. And the question that we have when we read something like that or hear something like that is why? Why did Israel or Isaiah have to run around naked? Why did Ezekiel have to eat food like that or lay on his side? And I think the obvious, or really the best answer that I could give you, is that it appears that Israel had ignored God's message so much that in these rare cases, God asked his messengers to do strange things in order to get their attention. That is, they were no longer listening to God's voice. They were numb to it. And so God comes to Isaiah and Ezekiel, and he asked Jeremiah to do some crazy things and others, and said, I want you to do these outlandish, bizarre, peculiar things because they're not listening to my voice. But if you can get their attention, and when you get their attention, I want you to illustrate the message that I have for them. And I would say this, as strange as those examples that God asked of Ezekiel and Isaiah, none resulted in more pain and embarrassment than the one given to the prophet Hosea. And that request comes in verse 2 of chapter 1. God asked Hosea to marry a prostitute named Gomer. We read it a moment ago. Let's look at it again. Verse 2. And the Lord said to Hosea, go, take unto thee a wife of whoredoms, children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. Now, what we don't have is Hosea's response to that as far as his initial reaction. I've thought about that again this week as I was studying and reading it over and over again, just trying to put myself in that situation. I mean, can you imagine what his reaction would have been? I mean, this is the voice of God coming to him and saying, I want you to go and I want you to marry a prostitute. I think Hosea's initial reaction probably would have been what our initial reaction was, and that is, you want me to do what? I mean, come again, Lord. I don't know that I fully understood what you were saying. I think maybe a word slipped in there that I wasn't quite clear on. You want me to do what? I mean, Hosea was pure. He was God-fearing. He was a clean-living man. And now he's being asked to marry someone the total opposite. Someone in which verse number 2 is described as a wife of whoredoms. That phrase means that she was one who repeatedly, over and over and over again, was a participant in sexual immorality. Now, why? Why would God ask Hosea to do this? Similarly, for the same reasons why he would ask Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Isaiah. Israel's not listening. And God wants to use an action sermon, so to speak. He wants to use a bizarre, peculiar life, real life story to gain the attention of the people. And so what the Lord is going to do is he's going to take Hosea's relationship with this woman to send a message to Israel about the faithfulness of God, even when his people have been so unfaithful to him. And that's quite clear because at the end of verse number 2, he says, the reason why I want you to do this is because the land, Israel, hath committed great whoredom, great idolatry, great adultery, great unfaithfulness, departing from the Lord. And of course, this is clearly seen as the story unfolds before us. I want you to notice four things tonight. You'll find them there in your sermon handout. The first one is this. Hosea, number 1, was committed to the unfathomable. Hosea was committed to the unfathomable. God comes to him. Verse number 2. I want you to go and marry this woman. In verse number 3, it says, so he went and he took Gomer. Hosea simply did what God told him to do. And again, the question is, why? Why would he do this? Why would they do this? I mean, the pain, the public shame, the unfathomable knowledge that the one you would claim as your own will have tendencies to give herself to others instead of you. Yet in this inexplicable situation that lacked a great deal of full understanding, Hosea committed himself to love Gomer. He committed himself to do something that was not like him. And he remained committed, even in the questionable situations that their marriage brought out, particularly with their children. And that's what we see when we read the rest of verse number 3 all the way down through really the rest of the chapter. Look at verse 3. He went, he took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bore him, that is Hosea, a son. So verse 3 tells us that Hosea committed to the unfathomable. He does what God asked him to do. It's inexplicable to us. We fully don't understand it all. I mean, he's pure and a godly, a clean living man. And God says, I want you to go take as your wife someone who is impure and ungodly and who will be unfaithful to you. And so he does it. And he chooses her because of God's leadership in his life. He chooses to love her. He chooses to accept her. He chooses her for who she is. And then God gives them a child. And the first child, according to verse number 4, is a son named Jezreel. Look at verse 4. The Lord said unto him, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass on that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So here's this first child. It's a son. His name is Jezreel. It had a prophetical meaning. The meaning is God will scatter. God will scatter, which pointed to a time in which God would avenge sin through destruction. So that's the first message. Call your first son Jezreel because I want Israel to get a message. And that is I'm going to scatter them and I'm going to scatter them through a great destruction. I'm going to avenge the sin that they've committed against me. And then you come to verse number 6, and it says, and she conceived again. Now, what's missing here, and I'll come to this in just a moment, is the fact that it doesn't say she conceived of Hosea. That is, verse 3 says that she conceived and bore him a son. It does not say that she bore of him once again, just that she conceived again, and this time it was a daughter. And I think the implication that I'm making is quite clear as we look through the names and understanding of these next two children. Verse 6 says, and God said unto him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah. And I will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, but by horses, nor by horsemen. So the second child was a girl. Her name is Lo-Ruhamah. And here's what Lo-Ruhamah means. Unloved. No mercy. So this weird relationship starts. You have a son that's his own. His name, God's going to scatter. Explicitly, God is going to scatter through destruction. You're going to have another child. We're not even sure it's yours, Hosea. So because we're unsure of this, let's call her Lo-Ruhamah, which means unloved. Again, a prophetical message. Unloved. No mercy. And this is quite staggering because what God is doing is he's sending a prophetical message of rejection. Can you imagine giving your child a name upon their entrance into the world that essentially sends a message of, I don't want nothing to do with you. Unloved. Unaccepted. As far as I'm concerned, the way you came into this world was not purely rejection. Then you come to verse number 8. It says, now when she had weaned Lo Ruhamah, she conceived, and this time the third child is another son. Then said God, call his name Lo Ammi, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. So this third child, Lo Ammi, means exactly what it says in verse 9, not mine, not mine, not my people. And I think this has two great implications. One is the prophetical message, like we've seen in the first two children. This time, it's not rejection as we see in Lo Ruhamah. It's not destruction and scattering as we see in Jezreel. This time, it's a prophetical message of renouncement. Particularly God saying, I will renounce my covenant because this is not my child. This is not my people. And so there's the prophetical message. But then it also gives insight of the possibility that this child was not even Hosea's child. And I think that's why I pointed out a moment ago, it's interesting that only the first child in verse number 3 is noted as being conceived by Hosea, but the last two children, Lo Ruhamah and Lo Ammi, do not specifically mention the same. And so it is quite possible, though we cannot necessarily be dogmatic about it, it is quite possible that two of these three children were born out of the adultery and harlotry of their mother. And that's why I get back to this first point, that Hosea was committed to the unfathomable. That he did what God asked him to do when it was inexplicable, when it didn't make sense. Why would I go and marry that? And then he accepts her and loves her and receives her as she is. And the first child, even though everything's okay, it still has a disturbing meaning. But the next two children, they're not even mine. Friends, this is an unfathomable situation. Yet where's Hosea the whole time? Right where God asked him to be. Committed to the plan. That's pretty dark. But then everything changes in verse number 10, because when you get to verse number 10, God says, even though I've said what I've said and the identification of your children, I want you to know what's going to happen, okay? Look at verse number 10. In fact, verse 10 all the way through verse 1 of chapter 2, they're just wonderful. God says, yet, all right? Here's the significance of that yet, all right? Jezreel, child number 1, I'm going to scatter Israel and I'm going to do it through fierce, violent destruction. Lo Ruhamah, unlovable, no mercy. Lo Ammi, not mine, not my people. I am renouncing the covenant. Yet, verse 10, the number of the children of Israel will be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. Oh, what's he doing now? Does that sound familiar to you? Well, that's the Abrahamic covenant. That's what God came to Abraham way, way back in Genesis chapter 13 and said, if you will by faith do as I say, I will bless you and I will multiply you and I will make you a great nation by which the stars can even number the sea by which God would give Abraham and form in the nation of Israel. Now he's renouncing this covenant. Yet the number of the children of Israel will be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it will come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there it will be said unto them, ye are my people. Ye are the sons of the living God. Verse 11, then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel will be gathered together and appoint themselves one head, and they will come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Verse 1, say ye unto your brethren, not Lo Ammi, but Ammi. And to your sisters, not Lo Ruhamah, but Ruhamah. You see, after using the names of the three children to predict destruction and rejection, God comes in and says, now their names are going to one day be changed. And what now is not my people will one day be my people. And now what is unloved will one day be loved. And now what is scattered will one day be gathered. You know what God's doing? He's saying, although you are not mine, although you do not belong to me at this moment, I'm going to show you through Hosea that I will do what it takes to make you mine. Friend, this message through Hosea to Israel and the application of principle to us today is a message of grace. Grace. God's grace, that though I deserve destruction, he will gather me. Though I am unlovable, he will love me. Though I don't deserve mercy, he will give it to me. Though I am not his, he will make me his. All because God, through the illustration of Hosea, is committed to you and I, who are unfathomable, sinful. Hosea, number one, is committed to the unfathomable. The story continues. Number two, he was faithful to the unfaithful. He was faithful to the unfaithful. We begin now in chapter 2, in verse 2, and no doubt some time has passed. Children are older. Mom is not around, however. In fact, she's walked away from Hosea and returned to her ways of harlotry, committing acts of adultery. It's a sad scene, really. Look at it there in verse 2. Because what Hosea does is he asks his now older children to go find her and plead with her to come home. Verse 3, plead with your mother. Plead. For she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked, set her as in the day that she was born, and make her as a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. Now, verse 3 is imagery. It's imagery of this idea of public shame and humiliation. It implies divorce. And what Hosea is doing, he's further identifying the situation. That I've taken care of you as you've gotten older. I've now accepted you as mine, even though you're not mine. So go. You're old enough to do this now. Go find out where your mother is. Go see who she's living with and plead with her and beg her to come back home. Because right now, this situation, verse 3 and 4, is so dire that it's as if we're not even one. And verse 5 shows her mentality, because she truly believes that she can get more of what she needs and wants from others than she can from her own husband, Hosea. Look at what she says in verse 5. For their mother hath played the harlot. She that conceived them hath done shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers that give me my bread and my water and my wool and my flax and mine oil and my drink. She's convinced in her mind wrongfully that her husband cannot provide for her, cannot give her the pleasures and joy of this world. And so she goes back to her old ways to seek and find it. And then when you get to verse number 6, look at 6 and 7. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up, this is Hosea, I will hedge up the way with thorns and make a wall, and she shall not find her paths, and she shall follow after her lovers. But she shall not overtake them. She shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband. For then was it better with me than now. One day, God says through Hosea's actions, she's going to wake up and realize her error. One day she will wake up and realize her emptiness. And then verse 8, she did not know that I gave her corn and I gave her wine and I was the one that gave her oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. What she thought was the provision of her lovers, what she thought she was getting through harlotry, he says, I was the one that was providing that for her. I was the one that was meeting her needs. I was the one that was giving it to her all the time. And then she would take what I gave her instead of offering it back into worship to God. She now is turning that around and giving it into idolatry with Baal. You see the similarities of what the message God is trying to get across. It was just as it was in the days of Israel as it is in our day today. That we who were unlovable, unmerciful, God comes and accepts us as his own, but then there are times we drift away from him thinking that God cannot give us what the world gives us, and we go back into our adultery and back into our harlotry, and then all this thing that the world throws at us is really God providing it to us, and we take his provisions instead of following in worship. We give it back further into idolatry. This is the whole picture. And then you get to verse number 9. Therefore will I return, Hosea, and take away the corn in the time thereof, and my wine in the season, and will recover my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness. And now will I discover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers. None shall deliver her out of mine hand. I will also cause all her mirth to cease, her feast days, her new moons and Sabbaths, and all her solemn feasts. Now he's getting really particular about Israel. And I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, whereof she has said, there are my rewards that my lovers have given me. I will make them a forest. And the beast of the field shall eat them. And I will visit upon her in the days of Balaam, wherein she burned incense to them. She decked herself with her earrings and her jewels, and she went after her lovers, and she forgot me, saith the Lord. And so in this parallel picture, this is what Hosea is saying, but as Hosea is saying this about Gomer, God is weaving into the inspiration of his word, his message to Israel. And he's saying that one day I'm going to expose the truth. And one day I'm going to judge the sin, and here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to take away their blessing. What Hosea is saying in relation to Gomer, everything I've provided for her, I'm gonna withhold it so that she will come to understand her need for me. God's saying, Israel's need for me, the message today, your need for God. And that what the Lord does when we have wandered from him, he puts us in situations where he takes our blessings away. To wake us up to our waywardness, we can lift our eyes unto his provisions and return back to a place of faithfulness again. Yet the unstaggering theme to me is that through all of this, Hosea was faithful to her, even though she was so unfaithful to him. What a man. He accepts as his bride an unfathomable situation. He's committed to her even when two out of the three children didn't even belong to him. He's faithful to provide for her blessings even when she thought she was getting it from other men. Committed to the unfathomable faithful, to the unfaithful. Number 3, Hosea was forgiving to the unforgivable. He was forgiving to the unforgivable. I think at this point, most of us would have simply walked away. I mean, let's just be honest. In fact, I just walked away a long time ago. But not God. No, he uses Hosea to show us a picture of his relationship with us. That he's committed to us when we have done the unfathomable. He's faithful to us when we are unfaithful and abandon him. And now he forgives us even when our actions are truly unforgivable. And notice how he does it. Look at verse 14. I love this phrase. Therefore, behold, Hosea says, I will lure her. I'm going to woo her back. I'm going to win her back. Forgiving the unforgivable. And how is it that he's going to win her back and woo her back to his loving embrace at home. Verse 14, I'm going to bring her into the wilderness. I'm going to speak comfortably unto her. He says, I'm going to win her back and woo her by my words. Verse 15, he says, and I will give her her vineyards and thence the valley of Achor, a door of hope. In other words, I'm going to win her back by my desire for her, to let her know that the door is open for her to come home, that I want her to come home, that this can be a hopeful situation in a hopeless mess. I want her, so I'll speak comfortable words to her and endearing words to her, and those words will woo her, and I'll let her know the door is open. She can come back home. In fact, verse 16, it shall be on that day, saith the Lord, they will call me Ishi, and shall no more call me Bali. And Bali was just a Hebrew word for the god of Baal. Ishi means my husband. And the parallel illustration that Hosea is getting across here is that Gomer, my wife, will no longer follow after the gods of Baal and the men of Baal. She will come home and I will be her husband. Verse 17, he says, I'm going to win her back by my words, by my desire, by my grace. He said, I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name. Think about that. What she has said, what she has done, what she has been doing, I will no longer remember. Grace. I will forgive. I will forget. Verse 18, and in that day will I make a covenant with the beasts of the field, with the fowls of heaven, with the creeping things of the ground. I will break the bow, the sword, the battle of the earth. I will make them to lie down safely. And I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yes, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and judgment and loving kindness and in mercies. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know the Lord. Hosea says, I will give her everything she missed while she was away from me. Mercy, love, faithfulness, justice. Oh, and don't lose sight of this as Hosea is saying these words about Gomer, his wife. This is God saying it to Israel. It's God reminding us that everything you missed out on, why you abandoned me, why you were unfaithful to me, why you were thinking the world could give you more than what I could give you, all that you missed out on, I'm going to give it to you when you come back home. All that love, that faithfulness, that mercy, that righteousness, I will betroth thee. In other words, I will remain married with you. And then when you come to verse 21, he says, I'm going to win her back by my mercy for her. Shall come to pass in that day, I will hear, saith the Lord, I will hear the heavens, they shall hear the earth, and the earth shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel, and I will sow her unto me in the earth. I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy, and I will say to them which were not of my people that they are my people, and they shall say, he is my God. Committed to the unfathomable, faithful to the unfaithful, forgiving to the unforgivable. Reminds me of what God would later say in the book of Hebrews. I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. If time would allow me, in these studies, we could point out so many principles about our life, our marriages. You look at maybe the things that have been done in your relationships and you think to yourself, I could never forgive that. And yet, God shows us through Hosea that yes, you can. You can forgive the unforgivable. You can be faithful even to the unfaithful. We're all getting to a climactic point of our relationship with God. Let me give you this fourth one. Hosea was loving to the unlovable. He was loving to the unlovable. And here's how the story ends, chapter 3 of this relationship between Hosea and Gomer. Verse number 1, chapter 3, God says, go, Hosea, and find Gomer. And I want you to love on her the way that I love my people. Look at it. Verse 1, then saith the Lord unto me, go, yet love a woman beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress. And here's how I want you to love her, according to the love of the Lord toward the children of Israel who took to other gods and loved flagons of wine. And boy, did he ever show her that kind of love. Look how far this love went. Look at verse number 2. So I bought her to me for 15 pieces of silver and for a homer of barley and a half homer of barley. And I said unto her, thou shalt abide for me many days. Thou shalt not play the harlot. Thou shalt not be for another man. So will I also be for thee. Hosea goes, he finds his estranged wife, and he buys her back, not for promiscuous purposes, but for love. Again, there are so many marriage implications here. How did God want Hosea to love his wife? The way that he loves his people, the way Paul said in Ephesians, husbands, love your wives the way that I love the church. Sacrifice for them. Sanctify them. I cleanse them. Redeem them. The way that Christ loves me is the way that I'm to love my wife. And God says to Hosea, you do the same. You go and you get Gomer the way that I'm going to go and get Israel. And you redeem her the way I'm going to redeem Israel. Buy her back. Do what you have to do. And can you imagine the shame of that? By the way, it doesn't have to take a very deep Bible thinker to see these extreme parallels. The shame of what it took to go that distance to buy your own people back. The public humiliation, the journey that he had to make from his countryside home down to the venues of the red light district of harlotry to knock on the door of that house trying to figure out which bed his wife was in and which man in which she abided with. Yet as he went from house to house and knocking on every door in the scum of that city, he finally finds her and he does what in that day was the culturally accepted way to do. Purchase her the way the other men had purchased her. But yet, in a quality by which he could only claim her as his own. The fact that it was her husband made the transaction totally different. And in that public shame, as he picked up his wife and begins to bring her home and says, I have not bought you for my pleasurable benefit. I've bought you because I love you and I accept you as you are. I want you to be mine and I will be yours. And she returns just like the Lord says his people will do. And that's how he closes it in verse 4. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king and without a prince and without a sacrifice and without an image and without an ephod and without teraphim. And afterward, the children of Israel, they will return and they will seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. And we see this in prophetical times played out before us. You see, the whole story is a story of a man named Hosea who was committed, faithful, forgiving, and loving to a wife that had abandoned him in the worst form of adultery. That story, Hosea, it's the story of our God. It's the picture of God's faithful love for his people. Israel, yes, is Gomer, but Gomer is us. In our spiritual harlotry, God did the unfathomable. He chose us. Yeah. The sinful, denigrated individual, the one given to idolatry and adultery and harlotry, the one that's broken the very image in which I created them. I want them. And he did the unfathomable. He chose us and he brought us into spiritual marriage, a marriage that we have with him. But yet it is true that sometimes even in this marriage, we are unfaithful. We go back to our ways. We flirt with the world. We trust its provisions more than we trust the blessings of God. And in this unfaithful state, we deem ourselves unlovable. But Hosea, but God, he's always faithful in love to woo us back to himself time and time again. And he goes to where we are, no matter how far, no matter how shameful, even the death of the cross, to buy us back and bring us to the purpose by which he has formed us, created us, and married us. That's our God. Whenever I walk away from him, he promises to never stop loving me, to never stop being faithful to me, to never stop forgiving me, to never stop his commitment to fulfill his purpose in my life. Can you imagine the scene in heaven as the sovereign God said, well, I'm going to become a man. And I'm going to die for their sins so that I might redeem them unto myself. I'm going to be their God. And they will be my people. Can you imagine as God makes this announcement in heaven and the angels look and say, you're going to do what? Yeah, God says. Yeah, I'm going to show them commitment. I'm going to show them faithfulness. I'm going to show them forgiveness. I'm going to show them love. Even though they don't deserve it. It's crazy, really, that Hosea would choose a woman of her kind, a rebellious, intentional wife of harlotry. But then it's crazy. And a holy, sovereign, perfect God of all the universe would take me, a repeated offender, a man given to spiritual harlotry. It's crazy to think that he has that kind of love and acceptance for me. That's why, friend, when you look at the book of Hosea, you need not see it for any other picture or purpose. And to see God, and to see me, and a love so amazing, that no wonder we call him Savior. And we thank God that he did the crazy for us.